Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Roxy DeMarco sat in his bakery delivery truck in Camden, New Jersey, expecting an uneventful morning delivering bread when he noticed a man approaching. Then he noticed the man's gun. "I thought it was a holdup," DeMarco would later tell reporters, explaining, quote, "I tumbled into the back of my truck among the bread boxes. He fired one shot and, thank God, missed me. Then he started along 32nd Street toward River Road. There were two little children on the road. I jumped out, grabbed them, and shoved them into my truck," end quote. Now, a stranger grabbing children off the street and tossing them into his van might not seem a typical act of heroism, but in this case, it might well have saved those children's lives. Because while the man with a gun would later claim he only targeted specific people with whom he'd had beefs, that simply wasn't the case. Not everyone in his path this morning had crossed him. Several had never met him at all. It happened at about 9:20 in the morning on September 6, 1949. The gunman was a 28-year-old World War II veteran named Howard Unruh. His descriptors will sound a bit familiar to us today, 75 years and countless mass shootings later. He was an angry young white man with a penchant for guns and a victim complex that seemed to stem from both real and imagined bullying. But back in 1949, he was an anomaly, one of the first of his kind in America. So when he began striding through his neighborhood with a Luger P08 semi-automatic pistol, no one had done a drill or seen a news report or read a how-to listicle about surviving such a thing. A lot of people in his path simply froze, apparently unable to comprehend what they were facing. They made the easiest targets, but they weren't the only ones. One woman died hiding in her closet. Her husband was killed after fleeing through a window onto the roof of a porch. He fell with a sickening thud to the ground below after the bullet tore through his back. In the approximately 12 minutes Howard Unruh unleashed terror in Camden, 12 people were killed, with another mortally wounded. He would never deny what he had done. In fact, he almost seemed to relish in telling authorities that the only reason he stopped was because he ran out of bullets. He'd meant to kill more that day, he said, including his own mother. His rampage would soon become known as the Walk of Death. Smithsonian Magazine ran a story about the case titled "The First Mass Shooting in American History," though inside the story, writer Patrick Sauer acknowledged that wasn't true. Quote, "There have been killers since Cain murdered Abel, and Unruh certainly wasn't the first American to take the lives of multiple victims," end quote. But Unruh was among the first to use a semi-automatic weapon, one specifically designed for use in a war, to achieve the shocking body count he tallied that day.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Howard Unruh was the oldest of two boys born to Samuel Unruh and Frieda Balmer. Born January 21, 1921, he was a bit slow in reaching some milestones, taking longer than average to toilet train, and not learning how to walk or talk until he was almost a year and a half old. The only noteworthy upheaval in Howard's early life was his parents' tumultuous relationship. As author Harold Schechter wrote in his book Rampage, quote, "The marriage of his parents was bitterly unhappy from the start. His father, a low-wage employee of the American Dredging Company, whose work on a dredge boat kept him away from home for long stretches of time, failed to provide the necessary security or companionship for his family." End quote. This surely left a mark on Howard and his brother James, who was born in 1924. The separation that followed when Howard was 9 had to have been traumatic too, given that separations and divorces were so rare and stigmatized at the time. By all accounts, Frieda did her best to take care of her two sons solo, supporting them by working on an assembly line at the Evanston Soap Company. She was pulled away often by her job, but she was also loving and patient with her boys, never resorting to physical violence the way so many parents of the age did in the name of discipline. To supplement her parenting, she directed her boys to the Bible. Howard especially listened, from a YouTube documentary by Dreadful Intrigue.
"He was a shy boy that enjoyed quoting scripture and had the ambition to work as a government employee."
Howard's interests didn't overlap with those of most of his classmates. He seemed almost allergic to sports and wasn't big on socializing, period, and as a result, didn't seem to have many friends. Still, he took part in the usual school activities. In 1932, when he would have been 11, Howard was listed in a newspaper story as having portrayed a quote-unquote slave on a float titled Plantation Life at Mount Vernon, which was part of a Flag Day parade called the city's most colorful patriotic pageant. Side note, some of the horses drawing the floats that day broke into a stampede and injured 3 children. Howard wasn't among them. 3 years later, Howard performed alongside a few shop class classmates in a 2-act play called Reaching for the Moon. By then, he was known by most as a lanky, 6-foot-tall loner, but at least in his high school days, he wasn't viewed as a cranky sort, just quiet. One report card survives his time in high school, the grades from which were exclusively in relation to his quote-unquote personal qualities. He got C's in mental alertness, health, initiative, and personal impression, and B's in judgment, cooperation, courtesy, and dependability. His composite score was a C overall, posted on a card that also featured his senior year photo. In the picture, Howard smiles in a tie and coat, his round-framed glasses and upturned nose conveying a handsome sort of dorkiness. It seems fitting when you consider that his only extracurricular activity was as a member of the science club. His other hobbies were reading his Bible, collecting stamps, and playing with train sets. After he graduated Camden's Woodrow Wilson High School, Howard took a few menial jobs, working as a printer's helper, a stamp press operator, and a sheet metal worker. None of the gigs seemed to suit him.
He enlisted in the U.S. Army in October 1942 and eventually was part of many armored artillery battles as a tank soldier across Italy, France, Austria, Belgium, and Germany. He was awarded the European Theater of Operations Medal, the Victory Medal, and the Good Conduct Medal.
In 1943, the Camden Evening Courier ran a photo of Howard, alongside pictures of other local men who had enlisted. At that point, he was still training in field artillery in Colorado. Soon after, he was shipped overseas. A skilled shooter, Howard had no behavioral issues during his stint, at least not the kind you might expect from a man who would later become what he became.
"He was remembered as a smart but quiet soldier that never drank, spent time reading his Bible, and writing letters to his mother."
It's not that Howard had no peculiar habits. He did. But those were brought up later as red flags in hindsight. At the time they were spotted, most people shrugged them off. This is Paul Brody of Well I Never.
Despite his stellar service, UNRU's section chief noted that he displayed a disturbing passion for guns and marksmanship, as well as for keeping meticulous notes on the enemies that he killed on the battlefield.
We're not talking notes like, I killed a man on this battlefield, but rather, as author Schechter put it, quote, like a birder keeping meticulous record of his sightings, UNRWA would make careful note of the time, date, and place of each of his kills. When possible, he would even describe how the bodies looked in death, end quote. But you know, he didn't smoke or drink or visit brothels like the other soldiers, so overall, he seemed A-OK. Howard was honorably discharged in 1945. From serial killers documentaries.
Like many soldiers, he returned home with medals and a collection of firearms.
He took those souvenirs to the Camden apartment he shared with his mother. His younger brother James, having married and moved away, was no longer living there too, so it was just Howard and Frida in a dank, three-room, second-floor apartment at River Road and 32nd Street. The unit, housed in a drab gray stucco, sat above a vacant storefront in a neighborhood called Kramer Hill. The place was named for Alfred Kramer, who, according to CamdenHistory.com, bought large tracts of farmland in the late 19th century that he then subdivided and sold on an installment basis to people of quote-unquote average means. This allowed working-class folk to buy a plot of land, which was a new concept at the time and proved hugely successful for Kramer. Kramer served as the area's postmaster for 15 years before retiring in 1893. It was still a working-class area when Frida and Howard lived there, though some folks were certainly better off than others. This was the kind of community where a business owner would often have a shop on the ground floor, then live with his family in an apartment above it, sort of like the Belchers and Bob's Burgers. In this situation, though, a lot of the shopkeepers actually owned their buildings, plus they weren't cartoons, so, you know, they were in better shape overall. Within a few square blocks of Howard's apartment was quite an array of businesses that drew customers from outside of the neighborhood, too. There was a pharmacy next to the vacant store beneath Howard's apartment, plus a grocer a few stores down, then a shoemaker and a barber and a tailor and a saloon. It was a pleasant community of hardworking people who awoke the day after Labor Day 1949 with no inkling that by mid-morning their neighborhood would be so torn up that one detective would tell a reporter, it looked like a battlefield.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
When Howard UNRWA returned to Camden after the war, he seemed like a changed man. For starters, there were noticeable differences in his room decor.
On the walls, he'd crossed pistols, machetes, crossed German bayonets, and photographs of armored artillery in action. Even his ashtrays were made from German shells.
But the psychological changes were far more concerning. Howard seemed unfocused, unable to even get, much less hold down, a job. He briefly enrolled in pharmacy courses at Temple University in Philadelphia, which was just across the Delaware River, but he soon bailed on those. Instead of contributing to the household he was again a part of, he let his mother support the both of them on her salary at the soap company. Whatever money Howard managed to get his hands on was spent on more weapons. Knives, bullets, and guns, including a souvenir Luger pistol, a handgun widely used in both World Wars by the Germans. Howard transformed his building's basement into a shooting range. Some neighbors took notice.
His actions unnerved his neighbors. In particular, Morris Cohen and his family, who lived next door and owned a small drugstore located below the apartment building. They regarded Unruh as a religious nut, a remark that he hated and perceived to be derogatory. Comments like this only served to fuel his anger towards his neighbors.
Howard had his own complaints. He thought the Cohens shortchanged him when they sold him their wares at the drugstore. He also butted heads with them because they didn't like how loud he played his music at night. And on top of that, he kept using their backyard gate as a shortcut, but he regularly forgot to close the gate, which let stray dogs get into the yard and empty their garbage cans across the grass. But Howard's tiffs weren't limited to the druggist in his family. He also thought the local shoemaker, John Pilarchik, buried his trash too close to his apartment's property line. The restaurateur, Dominic Latella, made Howard's shit list by calling him a gun-toting gangster. And then there was Carl Sorg, a teen who started using the vacant store beneath Howard's room as a pop-up to sell Christmas trees over the holidays. Howard was ticked that Carl tapped the UNRWA's basement electricity to light the trees up. As Howard's relationship with his neighbors deteriorated, so too did his relationship with his church, albeit at a more gradual rate. Before the war, Howard went to St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church regularly. After his return, he resumed for about a year, but then his visits slowed. They finally stopped altogether about 3 months before the shooting. Because Howard had been so quiet before, a lot of the people in his orbit didn't recognize his newfound rancor as a change for him necessarily, because they hadn't known him beforehand. But there were exceptions. One local woman, a motherly type, had known Howard well enough before he was shipped overseas to write him letters while he was gone. She told reporters later that when he returned, he seemed like a different guy altogether. He was quiet before, but pleasant. Now he was quiet still, but he always appeared nervous and slightly agitated, walking rigidly down the street as though he couldn't loosen up to even look around him. There was other talk circulating about Howard too. This time, it regarded his sexuality. Howard had never paid much attention to girls in school, and now that he was a 28-year-old man, women didn't seem to interest him. Rumors started that Howard was gay. Howard hated those rumors, even though they were true. He, in fact, kept a journal similar to the ones he'd filled with kills during the war, but this time the entries detailed the sexual encounters he'd had with various men, some named, some anonymous. In fact, on Labor Day night, some 12 hours before his rampage began, Howard had expected to meet someone for a date in Philadelphia at a Market Street movie house called The Family Theater. Author Harold Schechter noted that the name was a bit ironic, given that it was a well-known gay pickup spot. Howard had a particular suitor in mind that night, with whom he had set a time to meet, but Howard was delayed by traffic. By the time he reached the movie house, his date had bailed. Howard sat through 3 showings of a double feature running on a loop before giving up and heading back to Camden past 3 in the morning on September 6th. He was already in a sour mood when he got home, but then he found a new gate his mother had had installed in their property's fence, a gate meant to allow him to stop using the Cohen's gate in hopes of settling that dispute, had been vandalized. Howard decided that the Cohens must have destroyed the gate because they were petty jerks who just wanted to mess with him. Dreadful intrigue again.
It may have been a small and even petty insult, but for him, it was the last straw in a long list of grievances that he had against the Cohens.
In reality, the gate had been destroyed by some random local boys. It's hard to say what would have happened had Howard learned that before setting his deadly plan into motion the next morning. But he didn't know, and I suspect he didn't really care. He was pissed and ready to take action. No one knew this beforehand, but in addition to the journals Howard kept about slaying more enemies and sexual conquest, he had kept another that today we would describe as a kill list. As author Schechter described it, quote, 10 in all found their way onto UNRWA's list. Beside each of their names, he made cryptic notations. Rhett WTS or DNDR. The abbreviation stood for retaliate when time suitable and do not delay retaliation, end quote. The Cohens were at the top of the list. The morning after Howard's disappointing date attempt, he awoke around 8 a.m. to the sounds of his mother preparing his breakfast, fried eggs, and a cereal called Post Toasties. Frieda would later say that Howard seemed distracted, but she didn't think much of it, until he called her into the living room. He had gone to the basement to retrieve a heavy wrench, which he now raised over his head threateningly in Frieda's direction. The frightened mother said, "What do you want to do that for, Howard?" before backing away and bursting through the door to flee. Howard Unruh would later say his intent was to kill his mother first, so she would never have to live with the shame of what he was about to do to the town they both called home. Shaking off his mother's reaction, Unruh went to his bedroom to arm himself. His showcase weapon was his 9mm Luger, for which he had an extra loaded clip, as well as more than a dozen loose cartridges in his pocket, ensuring he had enough ammo for everyone on his list.
Unruh thought the world was out to get him, so he decided to enact revenge on his little corner of it.
He waited until past 9 a.m. because he figured that's when the stores opened and that's when he would be most likely to find his targets. He started with the shoe shop. Inside, 27-year-old John Pilarchik knelt by his workbench, nailing a sole onto a shoe that had been dropped off for repair. Unruh walked into the store about 9:20 a.m. and walked up to Pilarchik, who looked up from his work. Neither said a word to each other before Unruh pointed his Luger at the cobbler's stomach and fired a shot. Pilarchik fell backward, and Unruh fired once more into the man's head. Then Unruh calmly walked next door to the barber shop, where Clark Hoover was trimming the hair of a customer seated atop a carousel-style horse. It was white, with dark reins and hooves and saddle, and its rider was a 6-year-old boy named Oris Smith, who was getting his hair clipped so he could feel spiffy for school the next day. Unruh walked into the barber shop and took aim at Hoover, saying, "I've got something for you, Clarky." Little Oris's mother, seated nearby, watched in horror as Unruh opened fire, killing both the barber and the boy. Unruh didn't seem to hear the mother's screams as he turned and headed toward his next target. That was the Cohen family. Maurice Cohen had heard the chaos starting to unfold outside and rushed toward the entry of his drugstore, crying, "What's going on here?" He spotted Unruh headed his way with the pistol and dashed back inside. He must have crossed paths with 45-year-old James Hutton, a customer and insurance salesman who was just leaving the store. Unruh nonchalantly said, "Excuse me, sir," but Hutton, clearly shocked, didn't move instantaneously, and so Unruh shot him in the chest and head. Paul Brody again.
Upon hearing the gunshots, the Cohens had attempted to flee to their upstairs apartment with 38-year-old Royce, putting their son, 12-year-old Charles, inside a closet before locking herself in an adjacent one.
What happened next sounds straight out of a horror movie. Unruh made his way into the Cohens' apartment. He again spotted Maurice Cohen, who had managed to crawl out a window onto the roof of his drugstore's porch. Unruh aimed and shot a still-running Cohen in the back. Cohen toppled off the roof onto the pavement below, dead. The next day, some newspapers ran a photo of his bloodied, sprawled body in their pages. Unruh turned his attention back to the apartment. He could hear Rose whimpering from behind a closed closet door, so he fired 3 shots into the closet before wrenching the door open, grabbing Rose and shooting her in the face. Then he shot Maurice's mother, 63-year-old Minnie Cohen, who was trying to call the police for help. Even if Unruh had at this point believed he'd been targeting people who supposedly had it coming, he'd already killed a completely innocent boy and orphaned 12-year-old Charles Cohen, who was still hiding in a closet in his parents' apartment. And he was nowhere near stopping. Leaving the drugstore, Unruh began crossing the street, where a car slowed. Whether it was to avoid hitting Unruh or to make sense of Hutton's or Cohen's bodies lying on the ground, it's unclear. Regardless, Anra had never met the driver, but walked up to the vehicle anyway, shooting through the head 24-year-old television repairman and war veteran Alvin Day. Then Anra headed toward another shop. Before he reached it, though, he noticed rustling in some upstairs windows. A face appeared, and Anra fired a few shots. One hit 2-year-old Tommy Hamilton, who dropped dead at his pregnant mother's feet. She had tried to get all three of her children away from the window, but Tommy had been too curious about the noise. He would be the youngest victim that day.
Andrew then made his way to the tailor shop where he hoped to find Thomas Zagrino. Instead, he found Tom's wife, 28-year-old Helga Zagrino, who got down on her knees to beg for her life.
Helga was a school teacher. She and Tom were newlyweds, having been married just 1 month. Anra fatally shot her twice as she pleaded with him to spare her. Grocer Earl Horner had not been on Anra's hit list, but for whatever reason, Anra headed to his shop next. Luckily for Horner and his customers, he'd had presence of mind enough to lock the door by then. Anra fired a few shots through the door, but didn't hurt anyone. Next, there was a car. Just a random car at a red light passing through town. Its driver, 37-year-old Helen Wilson, had stopped at River Road and 32nd Street en route to take her 68-year-old mother, Emma Matlack, to a doctor's appointment. Between the two women sat Wilson's 10-year-old son, John. As with the other shootings, Anra didn't fire from a distance. He walked straight up to the car and fired 3 times through the windshield. Helen and her mother were killed instantly, but John, struck in the neck, would linger for nearly a full day before dying in a hospital, his grief-stricken father at his bedside. Next, Anra took a different tack, entering a stranger's home for the first time. Inside, its owner, a woman in her 30s named Madeline Harry, sat with her 2 teenage sons in the kitchen. Anra shot at Harry 3 times, prompting her 16-year-old, Armand, to leap from his chair and attempt to tackle the war veteran. Anra was easily able to stop him by hitting him with his Luger, then fired 2 times into his arms. Armand was alive, staring down his assailant as Anra pointed the gun at the teen's chest. He pulled the trigger, but the gun was empty. He had finally run out of bullets. Anra left the Harry's home and walked down the street again. At that point, he felt a stinging in his lower back and realized he'd been shot. He didn't know by whom, but it was later revealed to have been Frank Engel, the barkeep, aiming from a 2nd-story window. The shooting spree was over. Anra headed up to his apartment to barricade himself as police began swarming the neighborhood. What happened next shocked everyone involved.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
The shooting details, as I laid them out before the break, are based on Harold Schechter's book Rampage. The order of the attacks can vary, though, depending on the source you trust. Newspaper accounts immediately afterward had 2-year-old Tommy Hamilton's death as one of the last, for example, rather than before the death of Helga Zagrino. Frank Engel might have shot Howard Unruh earlier in the 12-minute barrage rather than at the very end. It could be that the pain only registered with Unruh as he headed home, out of bullets, his adrenaline waning. I mention this because that's something that hasn't changed much in the intervening 75 years. Mass shootings are chaos to document. As a journalist, I've helped cover several myself, including some in a limited-run podcast called Aftermath, and I can attest that even today, with our cell phone recordings, doorbell cams, and saved 911 calls, it's tough to know what precisely happened when. As I wrote in one story about a mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, teasing things out by the second is like trying to count raindrops. The length of time I took recounting Unruh's kills is about the same amount of time it took Unruh to slay and wound all of those people. After he realized he ran out of bullets, Unruh retreated to the bedroom of his River Road apartment. He laid on his bed. Outside his window, he could hear blood-curdling screams. Charlie Cohen, the now orphaned son of Maurice and Rose, hollered at the arriving police officers that the madman had killed his whole family. "He's going to kill me," Charlie screamed. "He's going to kill us all." Some 50 police officers ended up gathered beneath Unruh's apartment. They took cover behind their patrol cars as they aimed dozens of weapons, shotguns, pistols, even submachine guns, at his bedroom window, ordering him to surrender. Unruh reacted to none of it. Across town, a reporter for the Camden Evening Courier got an idea. He pulled out a phone book and looked up Unruh's number. It seemed a futile thing to do, but it's the type of hunch we journalists can't ignore once the idea hits us. Philip Buxton dialed the number. He later wrote, quote, "The result of that telephone call was one of the strangest interviews that this writer has had in his long newspaper experiment," end quote. After a few rings, Unruh answered the phone with a simple hello. "Is this Howard?" Buxton asked. "Yes," came the reply. "This is Howard. What's the last name of the party you want?" "Unruh," Buxton said. He added that he was a friend who wanted to know what they were doing to him. "Unruh, well, they haven't done anything to me yet, but I'm doing plenty to them." "Buxton, how many have you killed?" "Unruh, I don't know yet. I haven't counted them, but it looks like a pretty good score." "Buxton, why are you killing people?" "Unruh, I don't know. I can't answer that yet. I'm too busy." Outside Unruh's window, an officer lobbed a tear gas container into his bedroom. "Unruh, I'll have to talk to you later. A couple of friends are coming to get me." Unruh hung up the phone, then, choked by the tear gas engulfing him, shouted that he would surrender. He raised his hands in the air to show he wasn't armed and weakly cried, "I give up. Don't shoot."
And with that, he fell down the stairs, landing at the officer's feet. As he was patted down and cuffed by police officers, one asked him if he was a psychopath. In response, Unruh calmly said, quote, "I am no psycho. I have a good mind."
This wasn't the outcome most officers expected. While mass shootings were by no means common before Unruh, there had been a few. In 1903, Philippine War veteran Gilbert Twigg killed 9 people and wounded 25 when he fired into a crowd during a band concert. Twigg then shot himself. In 1948, 8 people were killed by Melvin Collins in Chester, Pennsylvania. Similarly, Collins killed himself before he could be arrested. In both of those cases, the gunmen were dismissed as suicidal psychos. In this case, Unruh insisted he was perfectly sane. In most ways, the interrogation that followed seemed to support that. Unruh calmly answered detectives' questions, saying he had intended to kill far more people. Quote, "I would have killed 1,000 if I'd had bullets enough," end quote. He described to police the path he took on what the newspapers would dub his walk of death. He seemed to easily recount every adult victim he had slaughtered. When it came to the children, though, he said he couldn't remember. He hadn't noticed 6-year-old Oris Smith getting his hair cut on the hobby horse. He had only spotted a face in the window of toddler Tommy Hamilton's apartment. He remembered shooting toward that face, but didn't know if he hit anyone. As for 10-year-old John Wilson, who at the point of the interrogation was still clinging to life, Unruh said he thought he'd only grazed him while killing the two women he had sat between.
He claimed to feel sorrow for the children he'd killed, but the doctor's notes indicate he didn't seem remorseful.
That lack of remorse absolutely stumped his interrogators. They thought, this guy must be nuts. No one in their right mind could unleash the terror he had unleashed and feel nothing afterward. The headlines about the crime echoed that sentiment. 12 die in Maniac Street Massacre. Children, men, and women die when Maniac silently stages death tour. Berserk Slayer yields as police use tear gas. Quick note, those headlines came before the death tally changed to 13 with the passing of Little John Wilson. The notion that Unruh was insane was backed up by 4 of the 5 psychiatrists who would examine him. Again, their issue wasn't whether he knew right from wrong, which is, in simplified terms, the legal standard often used today, but rather that he seemed so nonchalant about what he had done. One doctor wrote that Unruh retold his story with, quote, an impassiveness that is decidedly abnormal, end quote. The county prosecutor announced that because of those 4 psychiatrists' opinions, Unruh's case wouldn't be brought before a grand jury. Rather, Unruh would be taken to what was then known as the New Jersey Hospital for the Insane in Trenton. Around this time, Unruh's long-absent father, Sam, returned to Camden. He was the one who broke the news to his estranged wife, Frida, that their son had killed so many of his neighbors. He told reporters later that he had contemplated holding off on telling her of the children killed, but he ultimately decided, quote, that my wife should have the whole story now and not go through one shocking experience after another, end quote. After she learned the news, Frida cried, Howard, my poor Howard, he didn't know what he was doing. And then she fainted. Unruh's younger brother, James, told reporters that he blamed Howard's military service for the killings. James said, quote, I don't know how this ever happened or why, but I certainly know it is due to my brother's army service. Since he came home from the service, he didn't seem to be the same. He was nervous. He never acted like his old self, end quote. With talk of insanity swirling, one of Unruh's wounded, 16-year-old Armand Harry, insisted that Unruh go to trial. He said, quote, the guy is entitled to a fair trial even in this case with so many dead, end quote. That trial never came to pass. Unruh was diagnosed as having paranoid schizophrenia and, despite at one point being deemed competent to stand trial, was instead committed to institutions for the rest of his life, which was a lengthy one. He died in 2009 at the age of 88, having been confined for 60 years. Surviving members of the Cohen family lamented Unruh's death, if only because of its timing. Charles Cohen, the boy left orphaned, had wanted fervently to outlive the monster who had killed his father, mother, and grandmother. But Charles had died of a stroke 1 month earlier. A brother of Tommy Hamilton, the 2-year-old, talked to reporters after Unruh's death. He said that Tommy's picture hung in his parents' bedroom the rest of their lives. As for reaction to Unruh's death, James Hamilton, by then 64 years old, said simply, quote, I'm glad. He didn't deserve living that long, end quote. To research this story, I read Harold Schechter's book Rampage and watched a few YouTube documentaries. Some of the most detailed coverage came from contemporary newspapers, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning story written by Meyer Burger that was published in the New York Times. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoy. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.